Good afternoon. So last time, we started off by finishing up symbolic execution and coming to a different idea about how we can come up with test cases, and that we said, well, symbolic execution, we had this idea that we wanted to sort of systematically choose what paths to explore, and our solution for doing that involved solving this really hard problem of figuring out what input would get us down a particular path in the program. And coverage-guided fuzzing says, well, we still want to have that same goal, but we're going to just generate random inputs and see where they take us. And when they take us to a new path in the program, we're going to say, that's good. And we're going to try to keep doing that by starting from that test case, which got closer to where we wanted to get in the program, and using that as a systematic way of generating test cases. And this sort of approach, you know, turns out to be a pretty effective way of getting a lot of test cases for a program. And unlike symbolic execution, you know, we can do this on, you know, programs without doing much instrumentation and, you know, relatively quickly. Then we started talking about sort of other sorts of systematic analysis. So, you know, what you might not like about coverage-guided fuzzing is that even though sort of we kept things simple, you know, it kind of got away from this very nice idea that we can, like, look at the code of the program and, like, actually figure things out about it. And this is useful for security because when we're talking about is this program secure, basically we're saying, you know, are certain safety properties of this program true? And in symbolic execution, we kind of found this out by basically running the program in all possible ways. And that's just not tractable for a lot of real programs. So we started looking at sort of other types of analysis of the program we can do, and ones that we're going to make some compromises. And sort of there's two notions that we'll commonly hear when we talk about these analysis. They can be complete. That means that they can find any problem. So in the case of sort of our looking for use after free bugs, they'd find any use after free bug that exists. And they can be sound, meaning that if they tell us there's a problem, you know, it's really a problem, that there's really a way of making that use after free happen in the program. And we started looking at ways of doing this sort of static analysis, which were mostly based off something commonly called abstract interpretation. We abstracted the values of a program. In the case of use after free, we did this sort of abstraction where we said the value is allocated or freed, and we, you know, interpreted the program using that sort of abstraction. And this is a very, very broad approach that's really applicable to, you know, a lot of problems. And we saw that in doing this, you know, to make this practical, we often would do things where we would compromise both on completeness and on soundness. This didn't mean that the result was useless. You know, we were kind of walking this sort of line in between, you know, if we have an analysis where we have to be really sure it's actually possible to cause all the problems, then we're likely not to find interesting things. If we have something which finds all the problems, you know, if we want to make that run in practical time, we're likely to also flag things which aren't really possible. And there's a whole bunch of things that static analysis does to sort of simplify this. And so one example we saw is that we, like, would skip over code that looked irrelevant. And that, you know, technically ends up being unsound because we don't actually check, you know, does that code terminate, for example? Maybe it's not actually possible to reach the use after free because there's an infinite loop in front of it. We make other compromises, like we don't actually want to, like, figure out, you know, if each if statement is possible. So, you know, to avoid doing that very expensive analysis, we'll just say, let's assume that this is possible and work out what happens if it is. And another issue is we don't want to sort of explore all the possible paths. Or the problem we had with symbolic execution and why sort of coverage-guided fuzzing doesn't even give us full results, is that there's lots of ways of going through the code of a program, and we can't, like, exhaustively explore them, so we're going to make these summarizations. We're not going to find all the possible paths. And we can either do that by sort of missing some paths through the program. So one example is that that static analysis tool I was showing you before goes a function at a time. So if something happens between two functions, it doesn't know about it. But another example is that we might sort of make, when we have like an if statement, you know, so if we have if x else y and then z, we might try to say, you know, not try to consider x and z and y and z separately. We might just say x and y together do, you know, leave the value in this state and worry about that separately. Worry about that that way. Okay. So we'll finish up talking about abstract interpretation next, looking at an example besides the use after free context, and then move on to some other types of analysis that maybe are sort of more broadly applicable to security problems, including some where we're going to go from this sort of abstract domain and talk about things we can do at runtime that are kind of inspired by something we want to do all the time in these analyses. So before I get on to that, questions about things we covered last time? So last time when we finished up, we were looking at doing this. We're briefly talking about this idea of doing abstract interpretation. So here we're keeping track of is Qux allocated or freed, and we can kind of come up with this graph of paths through the program. And what I've done here is I've said, you know, we can get from A to B, we can get from B to either C or D, and kept track as we go what the state of Qux is. And I said, well, if there's two different way states we can get into, so for example, for B, we can get it into this, you know, we can get to B where it's freed or where it's allocated. So I have separate nodes for each case. And in this way, I can end up dealing with the loop without having the problem of needing to, like, have this graph go on forever. So I did this sort of summarization that I'm only considering is Qux freed or allocated. And as a result of doing that, I solved my path explosion problem for this particular instance. In that, you know, I only need to care about, you know, B if Qux is freed or allocated. And so I didn't have to consider sort of, you know, what if this loop executes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times, which I'd have to do sort of for something more like symbolic execution. And I think I finished up last time showing that this sort of analysis is something that, you know, Clang's analyzer can actually do, can handle this loop. So one, it says that, oh, we can allocate Qux, we can go through this loop, go into this if statement, free the memory, go to the top of the loop, and free it again. Or we can go into this loop, free some memory, free it again here, or use it afterwards. Sorry, this is the double free case, this is the use case. It's kind of a little tricky to read because these numbers are not, you know, not in order because, well, we go through the loop. So, questions about this example? So, this analysis seemed helpful for use after free. Let's try to apply it to our other sort of pet problem that C programs had, which was checking for array bounds. Checking if we have C code, which does array bounds. And there's been attempts to do this, and I'm going to show sort of what it looks like, but people don't end up actually doing this in practice very much because it turns out that we still run into the sort of scaling issues where it's hard to make this a reliable check. And this comes out from the sort of things we need to track and how hard it is to reliably keep track of them. So for each array and pointer, we want to kind of track the same sort of information that we tracked for that fat pointer approach for bounce checking, the sort of elements before and after what it points to, sort of the Dalet indices. So this is like the fat pointers, but we want to compute it without running the program. And we also want to track the bounds on integers. And our hope is that, if we find places where it looks like we can't bound the integers tightly enough, there's a problem. And there's some cases where, maybe this approach would work really well. So for here, for example, I have a function which I takes in an integer, accesses a global array. So it's really easy to tell, the valid indices for this global array are 0 to 99 because it's a global array of a fixed size. And I can look at this comparison here and say, I flipped this example. Make that to be greater than. So if foo is greater than 100, return. So this is trying to filter the bounds. And where we can say, if foo is greater than 100, we aren't going to get to b. So this is our bounds on foo. And this sort of systematic analysis can tell us, there's a problem here, programmer. And the problem is that, foo could be 100 or foo could be less than 0. And both of these are sort of out of range of this array axis. And this partially illustrates sort of one of the practical issues with doing this analysis is that, I found out that foo could be negative is a problem. And in practice, if we tried to do this on a real program, that would probably come up quite a bit and usually be a false positive because, we could figure out if we had context probably that some function's meant to be called with a non-negative number. But, that's a lot of extra work that involves looking at a lot of paths through the program, which is something that is going to make this static analysis very slow. But this is something that people have tried, and we can see example with sort of a bigger function here. And here I have sort of a pointer to the array, and I can keep track of how the indices change with pointer arithmetic. But I get into problems when I have manipulations of the pointer. I need to deal with that. And here I have my sort of two cases for foo. Here. And we could hypothetically come up with a warning for this. So people have tried to do these static analysis techniques for all sorts of sort of interesting security problems. And as you've seen, there's some tools out there which actually work and will actually find these. But for the most part, they don't try to do these analysis that involve going through complicated paths. Even though people have tried, there's not many tools out there which, are well known for figuring out if arrays are in bounds or figuring out across more than just a function if values aren't being freed. Because it's hard to make this reliable for large programs without making your static analysis tool take forever. But there's an area where these static analysis tools really shine and are really great. And this is for sort of common bug patterns that are often relatively simple. So for example, Clang's Analyzer can warn you about common errors like these. So here, and this, and these. So this first here is, the error is, I'm passing the size of a pointer, but I should be passing the size of the actual struct. And here the error is I'm passing the size of an int, but I actually have a pointer to longs. So this is a very easy thing to detect. And the analysis to do this, you know, it is a program analysis. We have to kind of, you know, we aren't just like doing text pattern matching exactly. We have to like, because figure out what type P has and kind of look in this expression for a size of, but it's not a very complicated analysis. We aren't like really tracking where variables go, but it's still very useful. And this sort of analysis can find lots of security problems in practice. And similarly, we mentioned sort of how string end cat doesn't do what we expect. So it just has a hard-coded pattern to look for, you know, that misusage of it. Where it says, oh, if you see someone taking the size of or something like that of the first argument to string end cat, you know, tell them, oh, that's probably wrong. And it has some other sort of local patterns. So one thing it looks for that's a little bit more complicated, but notably simpler than array bounds checking or use after freeze, it looks for cases where we can have a pointer to a local variable escape from a function. Some questions about these patterns? And I know some of you have been disappointed that, you know, we've been looking at C, and these tools also exist for other languages. So as a concrete example, SpotBugs is a tool for Java, and what it specializes in is having lots of patterns for sort of common bugs. And so here are some security-relevant things it looks for. So for example, simple pattern is it looks for opening a database connection with an empty password. Another pattern it looks for is calling the SQL execution function with a non-constant value. Now, that probably means you have a SQL injection attack, but yeah. And another pattern it looks for, this is a bit more complicated, is taking a value from in a Java servlet, which is a way of writing web applications with Java, taking a value from the request and using it as part of a file name that you're opening. So this is a little more complicated. So we're like looking that it goes from, realizes that we have this sort of path for the data. Questions about these sorts of patterns here? Now, there's something which came up in both of these examples, which we're going to visit a little in more detail, and that's these analysis where what we're doing is we're seeing if some value, so in this case, the pointer to X, in this case, a part of the request, made it to some place that is sensitive, in this case, into the argument to the file reader, in this case, into a global variable or the return value. And this comes up all the time in security where we want to say data from somewhere gets to a dangerous place. And this is a sort of very special type of analysis. And we're going to talk about it specially because it's very generically useful. And there's also going to be some variations of this where we don't do it on a program that's you know, we're analyzing the code up, but we do it to a running program. And it's really useful there. So a question about why does SpotBug say an empty password is a problem? So if we look at this example, the reason it's saying you would want to say it's a problem is that this is a database which is, looks like it's publicly accessible on the internet. So you probably want it to have a password. So I agree it probably wouldn't be a problem if it was some sort of database which wasn't. Though SpotBugs will still flag that as a problem. It doesn't seem to actually look in this argument here. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So there are a bunch of static analysis tools out there, you know, and for all sorts of different languages, including some, you know, so we have, like, I mentioned Java, so SpotBugs is probably the more recent version of this, of that. There's Splint was an old one for C. There's some commercial tools in this space, and there's probably, like, 10 more out there. There's Claims Analyzer, which I showed you, some specialized tools. So Microsoft for Windows drivers came up with their own sort of static analysis tool that is focused around looking for incorrect usage of the internal Windows APIs that could cause problems. And they require Windows drivers to be checked against it. Okay, so let's go to revisiting that issue prior of this information flow, that we want to see how data moves. And with a lot of stack analysis, we were like focusing on control flow. We were looking at particular points in the programs. But for a lot of security things, we're really concerned about how data moves. And so rather than like looking at how do we get from point A to point B in the program, we want to look at where data moves in the program. And a common way of representing this might be an information flow graph. So here I have some Python code, and we can say that the value A, it makes it into this format string here, which is why I've drawn an arrow there, which makes it into the description variable, the first cop value it has, which makes it into the value we add together, which makes it into the second value it has. And I'm sort of tracking where that value goes. And also we notice that that the value of A can make it into Y, as can the value of C. So on this diagram, I've drawn possible ways information can flow, which is why, you know, Y is going to be A or C. I've drawn this sort of summary where this is not paying attention to which branch of the if statement we take. I'm just saying, you know, Y can get information from A or C. And for looking for security problems, usually we're going to be most concerned about what's possible. We aren't going to be looking for, you know, exactly what happens. But obviously there's a compromise we're making here, right? Because maybe it's the case that B is never greater than 10, for example. So questions on this graph? Okay, so given that, we should be able to... Oh, and... Didn't mean to duplicate C there, but... Oh, and I have a slide for this. Should be able to answer this question. And this is based on the graph. So you're going to might have some complaints that the graph doesn't actually answer these questions correctly. And we'll get to that next. Okay, so we have pretty good consensus. So I think I'm going to go over them. And yes, I know there. Notice, no, I accidentally duplicated the C option for the second question. So, yeah, this graph like lets us pretty efficiently by hand figure out what depends on what. And also, if we generate sort of a version of this automatically, this is a query we can make automatically. And, you know, that's going to let us answer questions, well, that might be relevant to security. So, for example, if instead of returned, this was passed to SQL query, you know, this is probably some useful information for, you know, like, do we have a potential, you know, SQL injection bug, for example. Now, there's some choice I made in making this graph that, you know, was a choice that maybe wasn't right. And that's, you know, I said that for this if statement, I would just say Y depends on A, Y depends on C, and doesn't depend on B. But if we're thinking of where information comes from, well, Y really does depend on B. And this is kind of what sometimes is called an implicit information flow, that there, no, the value of Y depends on B, but only implicitly. There's not an explicit thing in the code that makes that happen. And whether like we really care about this probably depends on what we're using the results for. So pure like two, you know, security relevant uses we might have. So one use is we might be doing, you know, checking for SQL injection, you know, whether, you know, some user input, which might be A, B, or C, makes it into a SQL query. We want to find that out. Well, you know, which version do we want? Or if we're trying to figure out, another option is like, we might be concerned of whether private info makes it over the network. So for example, if you have an application on your phone, you know, you might use this idea where our A, B's, and C's are like your phone number and the return is like the call to send something over the network. And I'm seeing a mix of answers. And I would say that these answers are pretty subjective. There are big problems with both approaches for both of these. I would say I have some preferences. So we can see that there's like a split. So does someone want to defend that the left version is better for our sort of SQL injection user input to SQL query case?
It, for this one, it seems like if the return is something that could be funneled into an SQL query, that we only care what the value of Y is. But maybe with the one on the right, we care more about maybe if A is some sort of private information, what the control flow is to get that to be exposed.
Okay, so you're saying that, so you're arguing for, we want the left for the first one and, sorry, the right for the first one?
Yes, and then the left for the network.
And the left for the network, because you're thinking if A is private information, we want to understand that B is involved in this?
Yes.
Okay. So I agree that for figuring out, that if our goal is to like figure out what causes it to happen, we definitely want the left version. But do you think for determining if it happens or not, do we want the left version? I guess is what I meant to ask.
Yes.
You want the left version for if it happens or not?
Yes. If like A becomes is private and it gets exposed. So
okay. Yeah. So okay. So other. So I guess let's start. See if we have other. So does anyone want to defend? And I think you can defend it using the left version for the SQL injection. So why would I care about this left version here versus the right one?
Maybe one reason would be that you need B to know what part of the code will actually let you run the injection attack. So you need to make sure that B is set correctly so that you get to a line of code that will inject the injection attack. That's my only thought.
Okay. But we're not to see like if it might be possible or not, but just to see to construct the attack. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, okay. So how about, does someone want to defend the left version for figuring out if private info gets over the network? And I mean, so I know I understand you might've interpreted it as figuring out how it gets over the network, but does anyone think it's neat? We would want the left version to figure out even if the information might get out over the network.
If there's a user-controlled switch, maybe that says, like, don't use my, you know, advertising ID or whatever, and that could be B.
Okay, so you might want to do, this might be relevant because you want to figure out what switches are involved in that. Okay, so I think there's a more direct way. So let's say, you know, let's say B is the last two digits of my phone number. If there's code like this in the application with that value of B, it's going to tell someone about my phone number. And you can imagine we could do this multiple times and it would end up being leaked that way. So that's sort of where we might be concerned about that, is that, you know, that the information about B makes it into Y just in a less direct way. And the same is true for, like, getting into the SQL query, but we don't control, like, the actual contents of the SQL query, so it seems like a lot less likely to be an injection problem. But maybe, you know, it's could be a concern. But we have to sort of make a choice about this. And the problem with using this approach here is that this is bad for false positives. Because if we think about constructing a SQL query, well, we're going to have something like if order equals ascending, you know, query plus equals order by, else if order equals descending, query plus equals. So that might be our code that would construct this sort of graph where order would be our B variable. And we would probably not want to say, oh, the query depends on the order, because that doesn't actually tell us there's a likely SQL injection. So this is my reasoning for why. So this is why I would prefer the right version for the first question and the left for the second. Okay, so questions about sort of my reasoning? So this sort of analysis, so it's a lot. And something I haven't made explicit that we want to do is that, you know, to do this analysis, we want to choose what our sources and what our sinks are, and sort of our goal for determining if we have this sort of information leakage that shouldn't happen is going to depend on our application. So, for example, if we're looking for SQL injection, we want to look for data coming from, say, input from the network and making it into the SQL query functions, you know, the parts that, you know, that don't escape things. For a private info leak, we want to look at our sources. We want to identify where private data can come into the application and look for anywhere like it can go over the network. And there's other possibilities we can come up with, just are, you know, kind of application dependent. Now, this information flow idea, it's really nice. And we're doing a static analysis, and I showed you sort of lots of difficulties we have with static analysis, and most of them also hold for this information flow problem. And one of the ones I showed you was this issue that we had with pointers, that we had to worry about having, you know, two pointers to the same thing. And this occurs with information flow, and it occurs even if we don't have C code. So for example, this Python code here, X and Y are references to the same array. So if we want to figure out what gets printed here, whether it comes from the input, it does, even though, you know, there's no assignment to Y after we do get the input. And this is probably one reason why sort of the dominant use of this sort of information flow approach are going to be dynamic. That we're going to monitor a running program instead of producing sort of the static flow information flow graph. We're just going to see what actually happens in the program. Also, like our prior examples with static analysis, we can also have problems that, you know, where we would need to be path sensitive. So in producing this graph here, you know, I didn't like even record information that we couldn't have Y contain both A and C at the same time here. But, you know, that becomes important in some cases. So for example, here I have a Python function where, you know, the input can't make it to the output. That if that was, or if our sources were user input and our outputs were print statements, or syncs were print statements, it can't actually do that because of this flag variable. But, you know, we would need a path sensitive analysis to tell. And there are things which do a path sensitive analysis, but that's obviously going to be a lot more complicated. Now, another problem, which is related to this issue here, that control flow affects sort of what happens, is that we can have these implicit information flows. And sort of the most obvious case, and something that's going to be a problem, is that, like, we can just, like, print out the value X without actually printing it out using something like this. We just say, if it's 0, print 0. If it's 1, print 1. You might say, well, this doesn't scale. Well, we can like do if bit 0 of X equals 0, if bit 1 of X equals 0, and so on. And, you know, this is, you know, something that's going to be a problem in some scenarios, but not others. And so I say it depends on the intended use. So if we're thinking of like SQL injection, well, probably we're dealing with an application that's not trying to do SQL injection. So, you know, it's not going to have code like this. We're not worried about that. If we're thinking of private information leaks, well, then maybe we're dealing with a program that's written to leak private information. And maybe they'll say, well, if you're going to analyze my program like this, I'm going to write this if statement. And then that would be a problem. So far I've shown doing this with sort of static flow, but sort of the most common, the earliest applications of this are doing this as the programs are running. So this is commonly called dynamic taint tracking. So we'll say that values are tainted. So are tainted. So we might say, for example, that values which came from with private data are tainted, and that taint will persist as we use those values to compute other values. And we can modify our programs to track this, or run our programs in some environment where the computations will end up tracking this. And we can check whether values are tainted at important points. So for example, we can check if a value is tainted before running a SQL query. And so there are real implementations of this. And one of the earliest ones, some of the earliest ones are in some, certain programming languages. So some programming languages have a taint tracking feature where, you know, they're an interpreted language, so they added to the way they represent values in their interpreted language this bit, is this value tainted or not? And they support actually using that. And Perl is probably the earliest example of this, so I'm going to show you some Perl code that does this. So here we have some Perl code which has a command injection vulnerability. So what's the vulnerability? Well, we can read input into name, which is used to construct a directory name, which is passed to the makedir command. But this runs a shell, so this we could like makedir foo semicolon run attacker program semicolon and a command that will fail. And with taint tracking enabled, which is set with this dash T flag, Perl says, will not run this system command, but it will crash right here with this message, insecure dependency. So it recognized that the value you passed to system depended on something that was marked as insecure, as tainted, and refused to run this. And how did it track that? Well, it marked the value coming out of read line here as tainted because there's just a rule that read line produces tainted output. And when we concatenated that value with slash dir, the result was tainted because there's a rule that most operations that use a value, you know, will produce a tainted value if the original value is tainted, and so on. So questions about this example here? Okay, so you might say, well, how do I do this if I want to? Well, so the real fix would be to not make a directory by running a shell command. But if we weren't doing that, how would we do this? And what Perl decided when they added this language feature is that they define certain operations as untainting a value. And the primary one that does this is doing a regular expression match. So here we match the name against this regular expression, which matches alphanumeric characters and extract those alphanumeric characters. And this takes a value which is going to be tainted. And this makes it untainted. Because the assumption that Perl is making is that when you do this regular expression match operation, you know, that you're choosing a pattern which is going to make it secure and safe. And you could imagine that we could design other operations, but the important point is that when we're having this taint tracking as sort of a feature to help the programmer, the goal is to have the programmer's choice to take the value that might be tainted and use it somewhere to be a deliberate choice and not to be an accident like our typical sort of SQL injection case or this typical command injection case. Okay. So questions about that idea? Okay, so this is using taint tracking to help the programmer. Another sort of popular thing that taint tracking has been used for is sort of analyzing malware. And here the concerns are different. We're obviously not intending to provide something which will just disable the tainted flag. And we want to deal with kind of programs which aren't written with taint tracking in mind. And something that's remarkable about this technique is that some early examples and why, you know, it's so such a broad, promising technique is that you can apply this to kind of existing stuff. So there's this paper from a while ago, Panorama, and it says capturing system-wide information flow. So what this does is this is a virtual machine with taint tracking. So every value in the VM has a is this tainted bit. And what do I mean by value? So this means register values, memory values, data stored in virtual disks. So everything we have information about, did this come from a tainted source? And actually, they track more than that, just is it secure or insecure? They track, you know, it's tainted because it came from X or Y. And you can think of, as someone who's trying to figure out what malware does, this has lots of interesting uses, because we can ask questions like, where does the information this piece of malware read off the network end up? You know, where does the malware use the data it reads from this file? We can ask those sorts of questions and get an answer for them based on running the malware and keeping track of where the data moves. You might say, well, how does, you know, we this get implemented? And basically what we want to do is we have our custom VM where when we run, say, an instruction like this, which adds, you know, into memory at R8, the value R9, we're going to update this big lookup table of the sources of taint of values, that the taint of the values, where it came from, you know, based on that. And we'll do the same thing for like writing to the virtual disk, reading from the network, and we'll run a VM where we're doing this for all applications and the OS, and we'll get this view of, you know, if the malware read something in the network, what files did it end up in, and so on. Okay. So, questions about this sort of full VM information tracking approach? So the question is, why would you keep track of where the value came from? Isn't it only if it's tainted or not? So we could store in this taint table, you know, this could just be true or false, taint, you know, came from a dangerous place, came from a non-dangerous place. But more commonly, we'll kind of have, you know, a bunch of different dangerous places we'll keep track of at once. So sort of an extension of this approach is, rather than the value is tainted being yes or no, it will be yes, it came from the network, yes, you know, it came from the user's private data, and so on. We'll have a whole bunch of different types. Does that answer that question? Okay. Now, there's some things where, you know, just doing this approach doesn't quite work. So there's some things that they needed to deal with to make this actually practical. So one thing is that if you do the naive thing, well, there are cases where you'll find some things are tainted when they shouldn't be. So for example, if you look at x86 assembly code, often they do things like XOR a value with itself to clear a register. And our taint tracking approach here would say that, oh, EAX is tainted in the same way it used to be. So if you don't like take care of special cases like this, you'll conclude that values are tainted a lot often than they are. Another thing is that I mentioned earlier this kind of idea that we could evade this taint tracking by just like having an if statement, and it turned out that Windows just has one of these for completely innocent reasons, that the Windows keyboard driver, it needs to translate from a key code that's used for from the keyboard to an actual character, and it basically has a giant switch statement, and, you know, we want to say that this key code, you know, determines the value that's returned here, but if we do the standard taint tracking technique, that won't happen. So their solution to this was that they just special case this keyboard input function. And once they had this, they said, okay, that's great. So what can we do with this? And they showed some examples of these sort of very generic analyses they can do of potential malware that's kind of useful. So one thing they can do is you can see if key presses make it out over the network. So if you know the malware, you know, might have a keylogger because it's recording keystrokes, but you like to figure out, you know, what's that happening there, you can use this to automatically find out, do those keystrokes, even if like they're encrypted or something like that, there's some math being done before they're sent out over the network, do they make it into network packets? If so, which ones? You know, and, you know, that's probably a lot easier than like deobfuscating the malware and, you know, reading through its assembly to figure out what happens there. You can also, you know, figure out, you know, if network packets come in, where do they make it to the screen? Do they make it to files and so on? You can also use this to find things like information leaks. So one concern you might have is about spyware. Is it taking your browser history and sending it out over the network? So they can add a rule to say, oh, here's where the browser's running, here's where its web history is, and mark that as tainted by hand, and see if that taint value propagates into network packets and therefore to sort of automatically detect spyware based on this sort of obvious behavioral description of, if my browser history makes it out over the network, there's a problem. And there's probably a whole bunch of similar ideas we can use with this sort of this approach where we're, you know, just actually tracking what values. Now, because this is in a malicious context, there's some issues with, you know, whether this technique is really going to be reliable if we keep using it or if malware authors are concerned about defeating it. So let's talk about, you know, what could we do as a malware author that would cause big problems for this analysis. Okay, so we have sort of the most consensus that C is a big problem. So C here, if we do our straightforward information flow tracking, we're going to say, oh, Y doesn't depend, I meant to do this the other way, but I meant to do like Y doesn't depend on X, even though it does. And you might say, well, we could like look for these switch statements, but in assembly, it's actually going to be pretty tricky to figure out like where the switch statement ends versus just code that's like after the switch statement. But maybe we could do that, but that's a lot of extra work. It's probably going to be unreliable. You know, what if we have like normal assignments in here? You know, so that seems like a big problem. So the second most popular answer is A, that you might observe that, well, if we're doing this update on an add instruction, this VM is going to run pretty slow. And that indeed is going to be a problem. Now, hopefully we hide that by sort of having a virtual clock, but you know, we're going to have most of the sort of generic anti-VM techniques are going to be a problem here and something malware might do that's going to make this sort of analysis not work as consistently as we might like. And our next most popular one answer is D. And whereas C, we were taking the approach that we're going to make it so the information doesn't propagate from Y to X or from X to Y. Here, you know, we want the information to propagate from X to Y. Here, we're taking something where the true sort of information flow graph was that Y's information flows to X, and we're turning it into this sort of false graph that Y and Z's information flows to X. So we're adding this kind of false dependency. So this is something you might do where what your goal would be is not to, you know, hide that the information is tainted, but to make everything be marked as tainted. And that would confuse the analysis because, you know, if you get keyboard input and make sure that everything comes from the keyboard input, then that's not actually a useful way to tell if you're, you know, what your malware is doing. I would say that B was the next most popular answer. So B, I think, is unlikely to work because most likely to do this sort of translation, we're going to store the code we're executing, like the translated machine code that the VM's running, in a different location than the sort of real code. So the real code will be the machine code that the malware tries to read will be the original untranslated code without these extra checks. But if we were doing that in a sloppy way, maybe that would be a concern. So questions about any of these options here? So can I explain B? So probably, you know, we have in our VM, we have the sort of, so the translated code the VM runs and the original code. And we're going to take the original code and translate it to code with the taint stuff. But the memory of that it's going to read is still, you know, accessing memory from this code still reads the original. So the question is, this technique work for defeating debuggers? Why is it not likely to work in this scenario? So in this scenario, we can't... The techniques that debuggers use is not likely to be feasible for implementing this feature here. We can't, like, it's likely to be too slow to, like, set virtual breakpoints and do this, which is sort of how debuggers work. And we can't just add this in the middle of existing code because the code size would change. So our most likely techniques are going to be either that we're going to translate the original code to new code, or that we're going to make something like an interpreter. We're going to read an instruction and like have a, you know, look at the opcode and sort of run it by hand. Does that answer questions about, you know, why checksums are unlikely to be feasible here? Or other follow-up questions? So speaking of these two techniques here, which change programs. So earlier in the semester, we looked at Tigris as an example of a whole bunch of obfuscation techniques. And if you look in its library of transformations, it has one titled anti-taint analysis. And what does it do? It tries to disrupt analysis tools that make use of dynamic taint analysis, this precise analysis. And what they say, what they do is they copy a variable using control flow by either counting up to the count of a variable, sort of, turn x equals y into y x is less than y x plus plus, or copy bit by bit. So if y and 1, x or equal 1, and so on. And this is something we might be concerned about malware doing if it's concerned about us doing this analysis. And you might imagine, there are ways where we can try to heuristically look for this kind of thing and like add back the taint information. Okay. So I talked about this sort of example of doing this sort of very magical taint analysis where we take a whole machine and figure out how information moves on it. And this is nice for analysis, but it does run a lot slower. And this is sort of in more specialized examples. I'm going to give one here, which is this research paper called TaintDroid. So running on Android, as you might guess by the name. And they were tackling the question of, does private information on your cell phone end up going to, the network? And so they did system-wide taint tracking on a mobile phone. And, they can't do the thing of, running a, VirtualBox-like VM. So they did taint tracking where they had sort of modifications in lots of different places. So on Android, typically things run in the sort of language virtual machine. So this is the Dalvik VM, where Dalvik is similar to Java. So they modified the Dalvik VM. They modify the system libraries that applications use to track this taint information. They modified the file system that these applications use to track where taint information was in the files. And they modified the inter-application communication methods to also track this information. And so this seems like it's a lot more work in the sense that they had a lot of different cases to deal with. But the advantage is that their performance is, very close to the native performance without doing taint tracking. That you can do this without feeling like you wouldn't want to use this all the time, which is not true when we're making an add instruction also update another memory location. And, they found, and this was probably before people were maybe trying to avoid this sort of checking, using this, they could figure out, sort of these privacy violations that applications were making. So they did their taint tracking. It didn't track secure, insecure. They tracked, yes, it's tainted. It has information about sort of the phone number. Yes, it's tainted. It has information about the location. So they could track each of those separately and figure out, did it end up getting to a particular server? And they found, sort of a bunch of apps they looked at. They found a bunch of apps where, this application sending the phone number to some server, this application sending the unique device ID to some server, this application sending my location to some server. And they could figure this out even in cases where, they couldn't actually figure out the message format that it was sent with. questions about sort of what they achieved here? Okay, so I think that's where I leave off on taint tracking. So we'll briefly start. So just some logistics notes. So the next few plan topics I have is, so next I'm going to talk about systems programming with memory safety, sort of using the example of the programming language Rust, which is trying to like fit the niche that C and C++ have, but without being hideously insecure, which is typically what happens when you write C or C++ code. And my plan is to, after that, talk about sandboxing, which is the idea of running code without trusting it much. And then sort of my next two topics are probably going to be about hardware support for memory safety and concurrency bugs, but I'm welcome to other ideas about what to cover if I have some lead time. So if there's topics you're especially interested or disinterested in, let me know. And I guess I should note, part of my topic choice for this class is that we're kind of supposed to be focused on malware, and I'm also trying to not overlap too much with other advanced security classes like cryptography or network security. Okay. So I'm going to briefly introduce this idea of sort of a systems programming language with memory safety by, you know, going to first talk about the idea of why does anyone use C or C++? So Python, Java, a whole bunch of other things. They're great languages. And C and C++, we've learned there's all sorts of ways you can get these horrible security problems that keep resulting in arbitrary code execution from bugs, which are really subtle. And if you, as a security person, want to stop people from using C and C++, well, I mean, maybe at some companies you could say we're not writing code in C or C++, but you really should look at, you know, why are people doing this? And, you know, I think you can look at it and you can say, like, there's three big factors. So one big factor, which is always a problem when you're making new languages, is that there's a lot of history and good support behind C and C++, that there's lots of libraries in C and C++, the compilers are very advanced and well-developed, and this is something that you can strive to have a goal meeting, but, you know, it's going to be difficult. Another big thing that C and C++ have that's sort of a problem for some languages like Python and Java is that there's no sort of language VM. It's easy to distribute C and C++ applications because you don't have to include a bunch of other stuff with them. But sort of the biggest feature that sort of provokes people to say on C and C++, especially for applications which are often very security sensitive, like virtual machines, operating systems, like libraries for parsing images and video, is that C and C++ is what might be called zero overhead. And that's because you can write this code that's close to the machine, and in Python and Java, that's not really possible, and you can avoid the array checking overhead, the garbage collection meaning finding out what things are free overhead. So on, those would be sort of useful those are the properties they're looking for, and they're things that, you know, you really don't seem to get in Python or Java, that if you really care about not having an overhead, you can't do it. Okay. So we're going to look at sort of Rust, which is trying to fill this niche, and in particular, trying to get to, you know, this goal here, which is the main reason why, you know, a lot of people aren't willing to, like, convert their virtual machine to They aren't willing to write it in Python because it doesn't allow them to do these things. And you might say, well, how are we going to avoid these memory safety issues, you know, without having like garbage collection and array checking? And the sort of philosophy that Rust is going to use is that we're going to have these sort of safety rules that are going to typically avoid out of bounds and use after free box. So we're going to follow some rules. So for example, for bounds checking, we're going to follow a rule that we pass arrays around with a size and we always check the size before using it. And for use after free, we're going to talk about what those rules are. But the issue with safety rules is that they don't allow you to do some things either at all or fast. So we're going to have an escape hatch for those cases. There's going to be some mechanism of saying, don't do the checks for this. You might say, well, won't people use it all the time? The hope is that we can encapsulate that dangerous code in, you know, some interface that we can check very tightly. That we can use things like those very expensive program analysis techniques where we're looking at all the possible paths. We can use that on this little piece of code that uses this escape hatch, but still have a majority of the program, you know, be safe because of we're following some safety rules, like sort of always passing an array around with its size. And this sort of idea isn't new. So, for example, in Java, typically when you're doing array accesses in Java, you need to, you know, use an array allocated in the virtual machine, and it's going to do bounds checking. When you're allocating and deallocating memory, you have to use garbage collection. But there's kind of an unofficial escape hatch. So the Oracle JDK and OpenJDK have a class called com.sun.unsafe. And this class allows you to do unsafe things. For example, it has a literal wrapper for malloc and free that literally call something like malloc and free. And it has this get long and put long, which is literally dereference this pointer and return its value and store this value at this pointer. And the intention behind this is that if you're frustrated with all that bounds checking overhead, well, you can use these to get sort of direct access to the underlying dangerous machine features. And these are special cased in the Java VM that Oracle and OpenJDK distribute to actually turn into like a function called a malloc and the move instruction for get long and put long. Questions about this sort of escape hatch idea? Now, since I'm telling you that Java has this feature, you might say, well, why isn't everyone just writing their performance-sensitive programs in Java? Like, you know, they don't care about the zero overhead all the time, do they? And there's some problems that Java has that, you know, make this sort of not actually work out for a lot of the sort of applications that, you know, Rust will be targeting, for example. So one is that it can be hard to integrate the code that uses this escape hatch with normal code. Like if we're using memory that's allocated using this allocate memory function, we can't let someone access it like a normal Java object. They have to use something which calls this get long function. So it ends up being extremely awkward to use. And you might say, why am I bothering using Java if that's what I'm going to have to do? It's hard to deal with use after free issues using the escape hatch. So let's say I want to implement my fast int array. And you may have a question of when is it safe to call free memory? And, well, the Java VM, you know, isn't going to help you that much because it's going to free your fastint array when there's no references to it from the garbage collector. But if you'd like to free earlier than that before the garbage collector runs, you have, like, two options. So one option is you can free anyways and hope that no one uses it. Another option is you can free and like have a Boolean as it freed, but now you're checking that Boolean when you might not need to. It's not zero overhead anymore. So another issue with you sort of using Java is that, you know, passing data to and from C code and assembly code is a bit tricky because of the garbage collector. We have to like tell the garbage collector, hey, this reference is going to C code, beware of that. And that makes it actually hard to get great performance integrating in existing libraries. So next time we're going to look at sort of REST solution that gets into this domain, which is going to be based on sort of having rules that only allow safe things, including most importantly, how we deal with not having dangling pointers, which is the big, really tricky part and the big thing that Rust is doing that prior languages really haven't done. So that's where I'm going to leave today. We'll start with that next time. I'll take questions before I sign off. And I see suggestion, malware case studies. That's something I could consider. It's always a bit tricky to, you know, make sure it's not too abstract or to do that or not too in the weeds.
Gotcha. I thought the Vienna example was very useful. So I thought maybe if there's ones that were like more recent that were with some of the
content. Yeah. Like, and I think I've liked doing that. Like, I think the sudo example is another sort of good example like that fit that. But the problem is like, I want to like, those examples worked well because they're the important part is kind of simple.
Right.
And so I it's probably worth looking at some of those other examples and seeing if there's something that might be a good sort of half of lecture.
Cool. All right. Thank you. Have a nice day.
Okay.
Thank you.